in terms of mindfulness for men, I know you've done some studies on men, both in men who have psychogenic erectile dysfunction, as well as men with prostate cancer and those sorts of things. So what have you found in the male population?
Let's talk about that kind of psychogenic situational erectile dysfunction. So these are the men who have no problems getting an erection when they're on their own masturbating. Put them with a partner and they have a lot of difficulties. So there's a lot of performance anxiety, a lot of worries, catastrophizing. And believe it or not, we did this in group form. The first question we asked is, if we offer it, will they come? Or will there be so much embarrassment that they won't? And surprising to us, and quite reassuringly, we had, you know, lineups of men wanting to attend the sessions, delivering mindfulness for situational erectile dysfunction. And it worked. Why? Because we directly addressed that tendency to catastrophize, that tendency to be in that place of, will I get an erection or will I keep my erection? Because that's what mindfulness does, keeps you present. So we also found really great outcomes in that study, situational ED. The work with prostate cancer survivors is quite different because for the vast majority of men following nerve-sparing radical hysterectomy or other treatments as well.
Prostatectomy.
Almost all of them. Oh, yeah. Sorry, prostatectomy. Thank you, non-hysterectomy. Almost all of them will develop permanent erectile dysfunction. And if not right after surgery, they will within a couple of years. So the mindfulness practice is not about restoring erections. It's about pleasure. It's about reducing distress. It's about how do you expand the repertoire of what you're doing sexually to enjoy it. And so in that intervention, we actually delivered it to the couple. Mm-hmm. And we found that buy-in by the survivor's partner was actually really quite important for that frame shift of, you know, focusing on the erections and getting the erections back and considering that there's a whole buffet of other different ways of being sexual. So in that study, our main outcome was distress. Mm-hmm. And so we saw very, very significant improvements in sexual distress, both in the survivors, the prostate cancer survivors, and in their partners. Why? Because there was less emphasis on the penis. There was more enjoyment and experimentation with other kinds of sexual activities.
Yeah.
And so much so that now the urologists that we work with in our prostate cancer supportive care program at University of British Columbia are now actually making prostate cancer patients aware of mindfulness before they go in for their treatment.
Yeah. I will just clarify that not everyone develops permanent erectile dysfunction after a prostatectomy. It's usually about 15% develop some degree of erectile dysfunction that doesn't recover. I think that's really interesting in terms of accepting sort of the difficulties with erectile dysfunction, because we don't talk about that enough. And I think it is really challenging in today's society to say, I can still have pleasure without an erection. I can still provide pleasure to my partner. And I sort of have this discussion with my patients often, but I still get a lot of pushback. And I think that is really challenging. And I'm glad that your urologists who are offering prostate cancer therapy are talking about it.
Yeah, you know? Us too. It's been a bit of a paradigm shift for them, but they're also looking.
Some of the best moments in life are spontaneous, unplanned. But for men dealing with moderate to severe erectile dysfunction or ED, preparing for intimacy can rob you and your partner of spontaneity. The joy of living in the moment. Now you can restore that spark in your relationship with the AMS 700 implant, a clinically proven permanent solution designed for your satisfaction and your partner's. It's the number one physician-preferred implant. It's built to look and feel natural. Happy partners agree. 92% of patients and 96% of their partners report sexual activity with the implant excellent or satisfactory. It gives you the ability to respond to your partner's wishes in the moment, not minutes or hours later. The AMS 700. No pills, no injections, no waiting. For more information, visit edcure.org/podcast. That's edcure.org/podcast. Sponsored by Boston Scientific.
For other tools to offer to their patients who are suffering. And it's not for everyone, right? Because there certainly are some patients that simply just don't want to do these things. They want to keep pursuing other pharmacological or mechanical means of restoring erections. But for those who are even just a little bit curious or have partners who are mostly curious, can be a great adjunct.
Yeah. I think the other thing I would say is there's sort of like a whole host. I think, first of all, I think anyone with erectile dysfunction, whether it's organic, predominantly organic, meaning it's from the body, a problem with the body, could benefit from mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Because I tell all my patients with sexual dysfunction, whatever it is, that no matter what is wrong with you physiologically, there's always a brain component because it stresses you out, right? It can be devastating to not function appropriately in a domain that is so important day to day.
Yeah.
And so while I don't know if you've done studies in everyone, you know, every specific sexual dysfunction domain, but I always tell people, I think they could benefit overall from reducing stress, increasing mindfulness, because everyone has a problem in the brain, regardless of whether they have a problem elsewhere in their body,
exactly.
Because it's going to affect your brain. You know?
Yeah. I'm really glad you make that point, because, you know, I think historically we used to think there was the brain and there's the body, and those two things are quite separate. This kind of Cartesian dualism idea. And yet every thought we have in our brain has a counterpart in the body. Right? Some subtle, either physiological or neuroendocrine or hormonal change, et cetera. And changes in the body directly impact the brain. We have thoughts about it. We might have emotions about it, et cetera. So yeah, I'm really glad that that kind of brain-body connection is emphasized.
Yeah. And I think honestly, I mean, think about mindfulness, right? You're not doing anything besides thinking, right? You're focusing your thoughts, you're changing the way your brain works. And it is so powerful, not just in sexual function, but in multitude of areas. Like, it can reduce blood pressure, it can improve physiologic abnormalities. And so it is just amazing to me. And I really, like, I tell people these benefits, and I definitely get a lot of pushback. Like, I don't have time to meditate, or I don't want to be, this sounds too frou-frou for me. So what are things you tell patients?
Yeah, terrific. Because my patients will say the same thing. So the first thing is, you know, thankfully we've got a ton of science. Mm-hmm. And the number of peer-reviewed publications evaluating mindfulness for everything from chronic pain to managing anxiety to mindful eating to obviously many domains of sexual health and beyond is very, very impressive. There's an entire journal of mindfulness and some fairly good funding to support these empirical trials. So that's one thing I always stand behind, is the data. And the data don't lie, especially when studies come from multiple different centers around the world, all looking at the same thing. So that's one thing. The thing around time is valid. And we're not going to create time for people in the same way that we're not going to create time for them to exercise or engage with their family or do other meaningful things. And so it's about priorities, right? Mm-hmm. It really is about where is there some wiggle room in your day that you can implement this? Because although mindfulness is a simple practice, all we're doing is paying attention non-judgmentally, it's not easy.
Yeah.
Right? And the not easy part comes with carving out the time. Yeah. And sticking with it. And so one of the strategies I often use is I'll say, you know, you're already here. You've already shown up in my office. Why not commit to 4 weeks, right? A month goes by really quickly. And then let's reevaluate then and see how it goes.
Yeah. And do you tell them to just start with small amounts of time, like 5 minutes a day, and then slowly work their way up?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So thankfully, there are so many apps and other digital health tools, or you can even hop on YouTube and download 10 to 45 minute mindfulness. I've got several of them recorded on my website too. But ensuring that you carve out the time in the day so that you know what time of the day tomorrow is my mindfulness practice going to happen. And then keep a log of what time of the day, what was the experience like, what helped you remain present, what maybe got in the way, so that we can make those adjustments going forward.
Do you think people can practice mindfulness without like traditional meditation? I mean, I know they can, but do you think it's as effective? So for example, having a conversation like this where we're really mindful, right? Yeah. I'm not daydreaming about something else. Yeah. I'm really present. And similarly, like just even doing the things you're doing, like say you are, you know, you are having a conversation, or say you are going for a walk and just being really mindful of like the sounds around you or the way your foot hits the ground. Like, can you begin to incorporate that? And will it still be as effective as actually doing like maybe a mindfulness meditation?
Yeah, that's the golden question that actually has been studied. So what we know is that people who actually adopt a formal mindfulness practice where they carve out the time and they really practice the skills, that then allows them to be more mindful in their life. In the same way that if you exercise and you go to the gym, then when you're at home and you bend over to pick up the can of tuna that fell on the ground, you're going to do so in a way that's going to lessen the chance of, you know, throwing your back out. So that's the kind of day-to-day implementation of the mindfulness skills. But it's probably not the case that just incorporating mindfulness in your day is going to have those same quite powerful effects that we saw on distress and desire for someone who really struggles in that area. Maybe it does for people without any sexual difficulties, but that's what we want to get to, right? We don't want mindfulness to just be a skill homework that you do on the pillow. We want people to live more mindfully, mm-hmm. right? So that when you are having a conversation, when you are eating, when you are watching your kid's soccer game, you're there. And I mean, what's been fascinating is this whole other cognitive science literature, which shows the impact of multitasking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people are multitasking, they think they're getting through everything quicker and better and through their to-do list. And yet we actually know that people are more likely to make mistakes. The brain is slowing down. There's less enjoyment. And you actually save time in your day when you do things one thing at a time. So we kind of need to lose this idea that mindfulness is a waste of time.
Right.
And again, if you don't believe me, just look up the science. I mean, the science is pretty clear on this question that it ends up saving you time.
Yeah. It makes you more productive, right?
Yeah.
If you are mindful, that 20 to 30 minutes of mindfulness a day can pay dividends
yeah.
over the course of your day and lifetime.
Yeah.
In terms of desire, you've done some work very recently on virtual erotica mm-hmm. and how that affects desire. So I know this is sort of an emerging area.
Yeah.
And we don't really know yet. I know this is sort of early on, but what did you find?
You know, virtual reality, which is kind of, you know, the next frontier of where a lot of these kind of healthcare innovations is going to go. And in the domain of anxiety or specific phobias, it's been an incredibly powerful tool. So as an example, people who have a fear of flying and completely avoid flights, well, you can put them in a virtual environment, a simulator, where they actually experience all the same feelings of buckling in the seatbelt, taking off, being in the air, and then simultaneously teaching them anxiety reduction strategies like progressive muscle relaxation. It's been an incredible tool for helping overcome those kinds of phobias. So we've actually been interested in applying this to women and people with vulvas who have a fear of vaginal insertion. So mm-hmm. traditional, what we might call vaginismus, where there's a real fear. So these are the women who are afraid of tampons, avoid gynecologic exams, you know, either avoid or undergo with a lot of anxiety, vaginal insertion and sex and other kinds of activities. And while there are some evidence-based treatments, from a psychological approach, the traditional treatment that we use involves teaching them relaxation and then sending them home with progressive inserts. So vaginal inserts of a small size, and they sort of work through while they're managing anxiety at the same time. So the mm-hmm. challenge has been for those women where anxiety is so high, they get home and they just freeze. They avoid the activities altogether. So what we've done is we've kind of created a virtual environment through VR headset, where they actually are exposed to these erotic scenes. We're teaching them relaxation at the same time, and they're all in the safety of our research lab at our healthcare center. Mm-hmm. So we've done two proof of concept studies that has shown that in women with vaginismus compared to controls, we had 40 in each group, we can indeed elicit very realistic levels of fear and anxiety and immersion equivalent to the levels that they feel at home. And what we're about to start now is we just got some funding from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research is to actually try this in our clinical setting. So we're exposing them to that VR environment. They can control what they're seeing. And then they also have the table beside them is a small vaginal insert. And they can actually experiment while they're in this scene with using the vaginal insert. Again, all in the safety and privacy of our office. So if this works, this can be an incredible tool later on. We know there's much more inexpensive VR headsets that people can buy and, you know, practice these kinds of things at home. So again, super innovative, a lot of fun. And if this works, I think that we can also experiment with this with other kinds of sexual concerns as well, where there's that fear component.
Yeah, that is really exciting and fascinating because that plays a huge role in a lot of people with sexual dysfunction. And I mean, that could be transformative.
Yeah, let's hope.
You've also done some work on attraction and sexual attraction versus romantic attraction in both men and women. And you've actually found differing results in what drives both sexual and romantic attraction in genders.
Yeah. So most of that research comes out of my interest in differentiating asexuality from low desire. So asexuality is the individual who has absolutely no sexual attraction. They also have no desire for sex. So what that means with absent attraction is there's nothing, there's no person, there's no thing, there's no stimulus that elicits that motivation for sex. Versus a person with low desire still has attractions. There's still things that, you know, potentially turn them on. They just don't have desires for sex. And the reason why the distinction between those two groups is so important, it's in fact, it's critical, is because asexuality is a sexual orientation. It's not a sexual dysfunction. Folks who are ace don't want treatment. They're not bothered by their lack of attraction.
Right.
And thankfully, increasingly among sort of LGBT to QIA plus groups, they're recognizing asexuality as, again, part of that sort of sexual orientation spectrum. Versus the person with low desire who wants treatment, is bothered by that. So that's kind of the underpinning of my interest in attraction. So we've done several large studies where we've compared large samples of people who identify as asexual versus low desire, looking at sexual attraction versus romantic attraction. And one of the really interesting findings among that group is, you know, people can still have romantic attraction, want all of the non-sexual things that come in a relationship, companionship and trust and security and safety and someone to talk to without the sex, right? Yeah. So one can have romantic attraction without sexual attraction. And that's more likely in women than in men, right? So sort of what's underpinning some of those gender differences in romantic versus sexual attraction, that's an area of study that we need to do more of.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating on how those sort of those attraction measures can kind of lead to mate preference, right? Like what you are, what your sexual attraction is versus your romantic attraction, they can be very different. And they sort of set up a way in which we choose our mates.
Yeah, exactly. Fascinating area that clearly we have a lot more research to do
in. I think it's because we know a little bit in the animal world, but not as much in the human, in the human condition. You know, and I was going to bring up asexuality. It's a relatively uncommon identity. 1% is in the literature. Maybe it's more than that.
It's a bit higher now as we're studying it more, but still quite low, probably about 5%.
And you looked at one study where you looked at you looked at eye tracking visual erotica and sort of erotic stimuli, and you found that there was actually a true difference in not only asexual versus people who identify as normal sexuality, but even those with low desire versus normal sexuality.
So the eye, you know, why eye tracking? People might wonder, well, what is eye tracking going to tell you? So eye tracking can be a bit of a biomarker into underlying genetic, predetermined contributions to this. So eye tracking has been a tool that we've used for a long time to study sexual attraction in, say, gay men versus folks who are attracted to the opposite sex. And eye tracking can be a very reliable indicator. There's lots of other biomarkers, even pupil dilation or fraternal birth order or things like that. And so because we've done so much research trying to understand the psychological experiences of people with asexuality, we thought, well, let's start to look at some of these biomarkers. So again, among one of them was sort of eye tracking and visual preference. And what we found was that the asexual people were far less likely to fix their gaze on the more erotic zones in, say, an erotic scene. So a scene of a person masturbating or a scene of a couple having sex. The ace folks spent far less time. So their initial gaze to that area, but also the amount of time that they spent there was significantly less than people who don't identify as asexual. So what does that mean? I mean, we sort of need to do more studies, but you know, there's a growing case to be made that just like other sexual orientations, asexuality is also something that has genetic, pre-genetic, prenatal origins. It's not a choice that people make. It's not celibacy, in other words.
Yes, Yes. You said fraternal birth order. How does that, how is that a biomarker?
Yeah. So this isn't my main area, though we've done quite a bit of research in this area. So for a long time, the finding and the explanation was, so gay men have a higher likelihood of having older brothers than straight men. Right. So you might say, oh, does having older brothers make you gay? Well, in a way, yes. But the underlying hypothesis, the kind of leading hypothesis right now is the maternal immune hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that with first male offspring, the mother develops a particular HY antigen against, you know, or develops antibodies against the antigen that that male fetus has. It increases even more with the second fetus, and by the third fetus, this HY antigen, which may interact with a particular part of the brain responsible for sexual orientation and attraction, has its effect on later born males. Now, that theory is still, you know, it's not unequivocal. There's some conflicting data, but that's kind of the hypothesis. And so we've taken this and looked at it in asexuality and found some conflicting findings. So it's not as simple as, you know, a maternal antigen against subsequent, but there is an effect of number of siblings and the sex of those older siblings on asexuality. And we've actually, we have a study of 2,500 people of varying genders where we're just trying to analyze that right now and make some sense of it.
Oh my God, that is so interesting. Like, yeah. Literally very, very fascinating.